Nearly home. Isn't home where we all want to be? Reba here for Realtor.com, the pro's number one most trusted app. Finding a home is like dating. You're not just looking for a place to live. You're searching for the one. That's where Realtor.com comes in. Like any good matchmaker, they know exactly where to look. With over 500,000 new real listings straight from the pros every month, you could find your perfect match today. Ranch style with a pool, barn dominium with an in-law suite, Realtor.com's got them. Modern craftsman with a big yard and a treehouse out back, Realtor.com will have you saying, yep, that's the one. No more swiping. It's time to start finding. Download the Realtor.com app today, cause you're nearly home. Make it real with Realtor.com.
Pros number one most trusted app based on August 2025 proprietary survey. Over 500,000 new listings every month based on average new for sale and rental listings, July 2024 to June 2025.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
Okay, everybody, welcome to the show. Gideon, how's it going this week, man?
Going well. Just hanging out. Finished this movie up last night. Excited to talk about it today. Things have been just chill and nice. Mm-hmm. Other notable things I watched real quick. I watched both the National Treasure movies for the first time.
And it was Treasure. Great.
Frasier.
Wow, first time.
First time watch for both, and it was great.
How do they sit in 2024?
I mean, I thought they held up. Just really fun. Nicolas Cage is hilarious. I like the villains. I like the puzzles. It was just a good time. Yeah, it was like a fun Saturday night movie.
I can't remember. Does the first one get political at all, Gideon?
Not that I can recall off the bat, but I could be wrong.
It's anti-Brit because the villain is Sean Bean.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Okay.
I was going to say, this is one of the only Sean Bean movies where he doesn't die horribly.
Almost at the beginning, dude. It was close.
Yeah. Well, fun fact, I almost said Ben Franklin. Nick Cage's character in this movie, his dad is John Voight, who is Angelina Jolie's dad. Mm-hmm. And yep. Also the lead actor in Deliverance, which I really want to get to at some point.
Oh, yeah.
Which is an excellent, excellent movie, despite some kind of unsavory stuff that goes down during the course of the movie. But definitely want to get to Deliverance at some point. Yeah, that's awesome. And today you also watched the new trailer for Death Stranding 2, which was a movie in and of itself.
Yes.
Yeah.
Awesome. It was awesome.
Yeah. Well, maybe, I don't know, maybe we'll do like a live reactions, like one of these kind of kind of trailer things for the for that at some point and record it and put it up somewhere.
Yeah.
Awesome. Alex Princeton, how's it going this week, man?
Sam, it's going good. Very professional here. I'm eating tacos off cam.
Yeah? What kind of tacos?
Pork al pastor.
Mmm. Yeah. I like those with the pineapple.
Yeah,
that's some good stuff. Just from a local joint.
Yeah, and the liquor store brought back my favorite beer, so hard to get back.
Hey. Yeah, the beer you like is about to come back in style, as Twin Peaks says. And last but certainly not least, Neil, how's it going this week, man?
You know, it's been a long week already, and it's only Wednesday, but
mm-hmm.
I will survive.
Yeah,
I'm eating a meal. Succulent Chinese meal.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, what do you got?
I got some Panda Express orange chicken and Beijing beef.
Man, nice. I tell you what, Coral Ridge Mall circa 2006, you go up there, you head to the food court around lunchtime, there is a 30-man deep line for the Panda Express orange chicken. And I've the last couple times I've been in the Panda Express, I always ask the guy behind the counter, I'm like, let's say you get 10 customers, how many of them get the orange chicken? He's always like, 9. Like, that's all anybody ever gets at Panda Express.
That's amazing.
They also, fun fact, they invented orange chicken.
Oh, shit.
Express. Yeah, nice. Like the modern incarnation of orange chicken is an invention of Panda Express. So.
Damn, I didn't know that. Uh-huh. That's why it's so good, man.
I wouldn't have thought that either, you know, that they just thought this thing up. But yeah, it's pretty good. I'm almost kind of disappointed when I go to a real Chinese food restaurant, they don't have it. But of course, that's like you know, a normal cheeseburger restaurant not having Big Macs. So I you know, I think it's maybe a little silly, but I, you know, I do crave it. And what are you drinking, Neil?
A very like under syruped cherry Coke.
Ooh.
Is there anything worse than like going to the drive thru and then getting a soda that's just like, yeah, you guys need to change out the syrup?
It's horrible.
Yeah, that's,
I hate it so much.
It's that's pretty bad. You know, Gideon, the Muscatine restaurant that makes me think of is the Muscatine Arby's. What is up with the pop machine at the Muscatine Arby's? That thing hasn't worked since 2003.
Yeah, I don't know what's going on. Yeah. Over there in general most days.
Yeah. Gideon, do you like Arby's?
I do like Arby's. I remember though having a very bad experience with the roast beef at that Arby's, and we didn't go back for like 2 years. It was like Arby's in general, it was no. But I do like Arby's when it's good.
Have you heard the urban legend that the roast beef at Arby's comes as a liquid? Like it's shipped in as a liquid and then it like solidifies into the roast beef?
No, I heard that.
I don't think that's actually true, but there's something compelling about that to me, where it seems
it's like
almost
a blob liquid or something. Yeah,
right. It's like oobleck, right? It's like a liquid, but it kind of like congeals into a solid,
into a product. Okay.
What the hell are you doing here? Oh, we're talking about movies. That's right. Okay, well, this week we're going to be talking about Seven Samurai, the 1954. Akira Kurosawa film. Neil, how do I pronounce the name of the lead actor in this movie? Toshiro
Mifune.
Mifune. Well, I guess I just kind of buried the lead there. He is the lead. Would you call him the lead actor, Neil?
Yes and no. Like he definitely kind of steals the show.
Yeah.
And when we get into discussion, I think his role is very important.
Who does he play?
Okay.
The young guy?
No, he's
the crazy guy.
The crazy guy pretends to be a samurai but isn't.
Yeah, he's got the giant. It's not a katana. I mean, we want to call it a katana, but it's like whatever the giant variant of the katana is.
I believe it's called a nodachi.
A nodachi. Okay. Well, today I learned. Okay. Suppose a wakizashi. Do you guys know what that's for?
That's the short sword.
Yeah, that's the disembowel yourself if just in case you dishonor your family kind of sword, which we can get into a little later if you guys want to. Anyway, we all watched Seven Samurai, a 3.5-hour black and white, samurai movie, as you might have guessed it. Generally regarded as one of the greatest and most influential movies of all time. Certainly on any sort of academic compilation of greatest movies, always ends up in the top 10. I mean, I can't tell you how many times I've heard of this movie and how many times it has influenced direct remakes like Magnificent Seven and things like that. So Neil is the one who suggested this movie. And I remember when we talked about it at the very beginning of the podcast, he mentioned it among his favorites. And he said, Seven Samurai is, in many ways, the first movie. Like, it's the first blockbuster movie. So I want to get into that with you more now, Neil. So now that kind of we've all seen it. So tell me about your history with this and kind of when you originally saw it and what originally got you interested and what turned this into you know, one of your top fives.
So, for a bit of context, my dad's father was an army surgeon during the Korean War.
At Emory University, we are guided by a shared purpose and a spirit of collaboration. Students here push each other to think creatively and work together because we believe different perspectives lead to new ideas. We know that Emory's mission to create, preserve, teach, and apply knowledge in the service of humanity takes all of us. We do together better. Learn more at emory.edu.
And because he was a specialist rather than being in a MASH unit, he was stationed in Tokyo General. And at a certain point, he managed to get my grandmother to fly out on an army cargo transport to join him in Tokyo. So my dad and my dad's the oldest, and then his two next brothers were all born in Japan during the Korean War. So, you know, like my grandfather brought back some art, and, you know, we've just always had sort of like a little connection that way to Japan. And so growing up, we had a VHS copy of Seven Samurai on our shelf. And it was very distinctive because this is a long movie. So it was actually a two cassette set. And, you know, I didn't really know what was going on, but when I was probably like 10 or so, I had some friends over and my parents weren't home. And on the VHS sleeve, there was no rating. It wasn't PG, it wasn't PG-13, it wasn't R. I was like, oh, this is an X-rated movie. It must be. So, you know, my friends and I all sat down to watch, like, oh yeah, we're gonna see something here, man, even if it is black and white. Clearly did not pan out the way that I thought it was going to, but yeah, this is probably the movie that turned me into a weeb.
Yeah, well, I was actually gonna say that. So you know, your grandfather going to Japan, and then your dad and his brothers being born there, that I think that makes you like an honorary weeb in some way, where it's like you kind of have some credit, just like Gideon is like an honorary mafioso, right? Like you were born in Sicily, right?
Yeah, I was born in Italy. Yeah. Sicily, Italy.
Yeah.
Maybe my dad and his brothers are, I don't think I get that street cred.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's kind of like me being born a Muscatine. I'm like an honorary juggalo, even though I have never listened to any of the music.
You have told me stories about a Insane Clown Posse song about like having like an eighth grade teacher's head in your locker.
Yeah,
that sounds about right.
Don't try to lie to us and say that you're not down with the clown.
Okay, so this is the tangent of all tangents, I suppose, but I just aesthetically think the whole thing about like having a bunch of different albums that tell one continuous story and that it's like all part of this master plan, I think that's really cool, even if the music itself is not that cool. It's just something about the whole like, oh man, it's the Joker cards and it's leading up to this big epic, you know, story, even if it's total nonsense. There's almost like a progressive rock sensibility to that that I really like. Anyway, back to Seven Samurai. Go ahead. Did we lose Neil?
You still there?
Oh, I was just sorry. Go ahead.
I was just gonna say, like, aren't juggalos the modern samurai?
To some people.
Yeah. They do have, well, I don't know if the samurai ever had like a gathering, but they do have that, you know. Still, it's something, you know, before we pass the age where it's cool, we got to go to the gathering of the juggalos. Anyway, so you sat down to watch this movie with your friends, thinking that it was going to be a blurry 1954 X-rated VHS, and you had your mind blown by the samurai movie. Is that basically?
Yeah, basically, like, you know, when it turned out it wasn't what we thought it was, my friends all left, and I just sat there to, and I was like, oh yeah, you guys go play football in the yard. I'm gonna watch this 3-hour movie.
Mm-hmm.
I was just hooked.
Yeah. So what do you think initially hooked you about this movie? Because I would say that my reaction as a first time watcher of this movie is that this is somewhat a symptom of the movies in the 50s and 60s just generally being longer and slower.
Mm-hmm.
But the thing I would say that stands out to me, one of the things that stands out to me about this movie, is that the plot is incredibly simple. Not, I don't mean that in a good way or a bad way, but the plot is incredibly simple for a movie that is 3.5 hours long.
Yeah. I mean, like, I think it definitely has sort of elements of just like being from the time that it is, where like it has a built-in intermission. And I think this just sort of comes from a time when, you know, you went to the movies and you could, you know, you were expecting to either like see 2 or 3 movies for your one ticket, or watch one really long thing. Like you made a night of it, kind of thing.
Right. You're going to the movies, not a movie.
But yeah, like, I mean, for me, you know, there was just like you said, it's a very simple story at its root, but you know, I hadn't really been exposed to like Japanese culture or history up to that point, so just like, you know, this being the fledgling weeb, like, what are they wearing? Why do they not have like, why do their swords look that way? Why aren't they wearing armor like knights? Like, what's going on here? I don't get it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I suppose it would all feel pretty pretty foreign. Alex Princeton, go ahead.
Yeah, I had a question, and just to see if I'm interpreting you right, Sam. This was the first time watch for me. I agree, it's a long movie, and there are elements that are like slow or slower feeling, and we can talk about that. But like, at no point for me did this film feel like it dragged. And certainly in our tenure here, we've watched much shorter films that felt like much more of a drag than this. I'm curious though if you felt like it dragged at points.
I don't think dragged is really the right way to put it, because it's not like there's a lot of fat on the movie. It's just a big movie, right? There was no scene where I was like, you know, I could really do without this. It was just like they established at the beginning, they're like, we're gonna get pillaged by bandits, we need to go get some samurai. They get the samurai. They set up for the invasion forever, and then we get a bunch of fight scenes, and then it's over. There really wasn't I was expecting there to be, I don't want to say a twist. I don't mean like an M. Night Shyamalan yeah. thing. I was expecting something more to happen, but it was something really like, nope.
Surprising. Some kind of surprise.
Yeah, and that really never happens. I mean, there are characters that die, and I definitely want to get into that. And there are great characters, and definitely the thing that I think is the strongest about this movie in particular is Toshirô Mifune's performance as Kiki. What is it?
Kikuchi.
Yep. Okay. That is one of the best on-screen performances I've ever seen in my life, in my opinion. And a great example. We're going to bring this back to Nick Cage. A great example of the pre-Marlon Brando school of acting, because like when I watch him in this movie, I'm thinking of like Charlie Chaplin and Buster Keaton and the great pre-Brando actors, like with his physicality. He's so funny. And like when I'm watching him, I'm not like, oh, what a great dramatic actor. I'm like, this guy is super fun to watch. You know, like that. That's the stuff that really stood out to me. His performance is what stood out to me the most. Go ahead.
It's just worth noting that he and Akira Kurosawa, the director, had a long history yep. of working together. Like, he's not in every Kurosawa movie, but like, I want to say like upwards of like 75%. Like he's mm-hmm. just a constant, either as a lead or a strong support.
Yeah, and we'll hit that with other directors over time, like Jimmy Stewart and Alfred Hitchcock is another great example. I'm trying to think of others off the top of my head, but Mel Brooks and Gene Wilder and things like that. So before we get too much further into it, let's get Gideon. You've seen this movie before. Yep.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So this is actually a second time watch for me. The first time watch was right about a year ago, maybe a year, a month ago. And the first time I watched it, I had a friend over and he was visiting while I lived out in Colorado. And it was like at the end of our time hanging out together. And so we were trying to like fit in this movie. And I felt like I was so like preoccupied with like trying to do as many things as we could before like he had to go back that it was like hard for me to just like enjoy the movie. And I felt similarly to like how you were saying, Sam, like it almost felt strange to me, like, okay, like this is a, you know, a really big, huge, epic, like runtime movie about what is basically just like a small little village and this small story that happened. So I didn't like fully get it, and I thought it was cool, but I was like, I didn't fully wrap my head around it. But on this rewatch, I feel like it clicked so much more, and I was able to just like really soak it in and appreciate it and see why it's so like lauded and everything. And I just really dug it, and I think it'll be a really interesting movie to revisit over the years, and I'm just kind of excited to even have seen it, I guess, and be able to talk about it. It feels last thing I'll say, but yeah. it feels like, you know, it's that movie you've always heard about, or like if you're wanting to get more into movies and films, like you gotta watch this one. And even recently I've been watching like lots of older classic black and white stuff. And so it was kind of nice almost like getting more experience with this older style leading into my rewatch of Seven Samurai. I think that helped.
Yeah. Alex Prinzen, give me your history with this. You watched this with Neil, right?
Yeah, that's all I had is history. I mean, I knew going in it was epic runtime. I knew some of the things I think we'll get into, that this is like a huge influence on the Western and maybe like thereby lots of other Western modern media phenomena. No history other than that. Yeah. I'll say up front, I really enjoyed it. I think some elements of the slowness and pacing really resonate with me. My favorite thing about old movies is how the shots are like very long and not so jumpy, and you really get to like absorb someone. The actors are expressive with their faces and their bodies. I find it like so relaxing and kind of refreshing.
Mm-hmm. Agreed.
So yeah, loved it.
It is certainly a movie of a completely different era technologically. So therefore movie making techniques were not as established, and actors were doing a completely different thing. Like we talked about with kind of like the pre-post Brando era acting. And yeah, it's just really interesting to watch on a technical level. Something that definitely stood out to me, again, like we never ended up doing a podcast about Le Grand Illusion, but something I remember thinking to myself when we watched it was that it was extremely archaic in terms of like there are filmmaking techniques and directorial techniques you do with the camera. Like if we have a still frame on somebody and then it fades to black and then it fades up from black, we kind of all understand that time has passed, right? It's just like a universal way that like visually film communicates ideas. Le Grand Illusion was jumping all over the place with its like timeline, and it was just jump cutting, and there was no like really clear explanation as to what was going on. Seven Samurai is so much better than that. I don't want to say, you know, necessarily it's a better movie. I mean, they're 30 years apart and they're completely different genres and made across the world from each other, but it was much more advanced in its directing.
And like visual language.
Yeah. And in terms of its like visual language, although I will say in some ways, like this movie is like, okay, so it's 1954. This movie is at least 15 years after The Wizard of Oz. Right. And I know they're so different, and I know that Japan, especially just only less than 10 years after getting the absolute shit bombed out of them by us, was in no place to be buying like expensive camera equipment and have Technicolor in their movies and all these special effects and everything. But again, I think this movie really underscores something I felt with The Grand Illusion, which was that the United States was just so far ahead technologically of everybody else that was making movies in the earlier part of the 20th century. I mean, that is really like one of the main standouts. I'm not saying that it makes it a better movie or a worse movie or anything like that. I'm just saying in a purely production value sense, it's amazing to look at this and then you look at something like The Wizard of Oz, which was made so much earlier. I don't know if anybody else had feelings about that.
I'm actually really curious about, like, and I haven't looked into this, but the budgeting, et cetera, for this film, because there are some pretty compelling practical effects. The two things that come to mind are the horse budget for this movie had to be substantial, and then the choreography of the battle scenes where they really do look like they're fighting. And then Neil, you told me some things about the rain in the final battle that you may care to share, but the rain is beautiful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And even the burning buildings too.
Oh yeah, the burning buildings. Yeah. I mean, they had to build this set and then just destroy it.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Not crazy.
So it isn't like it looks cheap, you know. It isn't like, you know, like, right. And I don't think that's what you're saying.
I think they did
excellent work with whatever tools they had available.
Right. I'm just saying that one country had been doing this for like 30 years and making had an entire industry wrapped around it. And basically everybody else in the world was doing comparatively very low budget, very low production value stuff. Not to say the Severed Samurai looks cheap, because I agree. The building is burning down. And like you said, the horse budget. And I believe at the time it was made, it was the most expensive Japanese movie ever produced up to that point. Toho actually pulled funding and was like going to cancel it like three different times.
Holy shit. And
Akira Kurosawa just would, like, what I read is that he would just he'd go on a fishing trip and then like come back from his fishing trip, and then they had settled down about it, and they ended up giving him the money, because he knew that they had already spent too much money and they weren't going to like just throw it all away just to tell him to go fuck himself. Wow. So he was like such a experienced director and filmmaker at that point that he knew that they weren't going to pull the funding for this movie. And then obviously it ended up being a huge success. Gideon also pointed this out to me earlier today. 1954 is also the premiere year of Godzilla. So Toho had a good year this year.
Banger year.
Let me just share the number. That's an interesting point. Huge box office breaker, budget breaker, $600,000. That's like a modern American mortgage.
I plugged in the number with inflation, and it's a little less than $6.5 million.
Yeah, that's not crazy at all, is it?
No, that's like a Woody Allen movie. I mean, that's like a pretty small budget. But honestly, but again, really, you know, they didn't have to pay a team of visual effects artists. I mean, they just,
or a cast, you know, of American actors.
Right.
Yeah.
No, well, that's a great point. I mean, like, Mifune probably got paid a lot comparatively for this movie, but everybody else in this movie probably made, you know, Dick Squidley, you know, and wasn't paid hardly anything. By the way, I looked it up. There was like one actor in this movie that's still alive today.
Damn.
I thought for sure there was going to be just a few, because typically speaking, Japanese people live to be like 120, but no, there was just like one guy, and it was like a guy that's like in the background of Sunshot, and he's like 98. He's like the only guy still living or something like that. So where else do we want to be? I feel like we haven't talked about the actual movie at all. Neil, do you maybe want to kind of crack it and say like some things about the plot, or there's not that much to say about the synopsis, right? Because it can be explained in like two sentences, but kind of your favorite bits and your favorite bits of the actual storytelling.
So basic premise is a small village is sort of cyclically raided by a group of bandits. Like, it seems like this has been something that's been going on for a while. And basically, like, the bandits come in, take all the peasants' rice, and then leave them just enough to survive on and plant a new crop. And we also later find out that the bandits also like abduct the pretty women from the village. And the peasants are finally at this point where like the village is just going to die of starvation because it's just being raided so periodically that they come to the conclusion that they need to hire samurai to defend them. But of course, the problem is that they don't have anything of value. So it's literally, come and fight for us and we will feed you. It's set in the late 1500s during the Japanese Warring States period, where a bunch of like rival warlords were battling it out amongst themselves for supremacy. And eventually the Tokugawa clan would win out and unify Japan up until the 1800s. So this is sort of like the point where Japan becomes a unified country. But at this point, like, there's no central government. There's no like police that the villagers can go to. There's no defense except what they can put together. But two really strong, like, we talked about like fundamentals of movies, that Seven Samurai is widely considered to be like the forerunner of, is number one, like, bringing together the team. Like, you have to, you have to bring in the team of people to take on whatever the challenge is. You know, so you've got the guy who can climb, the guy who can, you know, the sniper, the guy who can pick locks. Like, everybody's got a distinct skill or like personality trait. And so part of the reason this movie runs so long is that they spend, you know, like a 10 to 15 minute vignette on each of the characters before they ever get to the village, because they're introducing these guys as the team is assembled. And we also get a lot of like, you know, these archetypes exist in like novel and written form before this, but you've got like the older guy who's kind of a jack of all trades and he's the leader, and he takes on like an apprentice who's younger and not as skilled and is like learning from him. But I think one of my favorite scenes in the movie is when they introduce Shimada, who is the leader. And to a certain extent, I think it helps to be Japanese, so you would recognize these like cultural markers more readily than, you know, it's just like we have our perceptions in the West of like things that they just come naturally to us. And my first time, I was very confused as to what was happening when I was 10. But there's a child who's being held hostage by a thief inside of a barn. And the samurai shaves his head, which is like to a samurai would be like not, it would be like a grave dishonor to like cut off your signifying hairdo. But he borrows like a monk's vestments and then approaches the bandit, offering him and the child food, and then uses that as a guise to get close and kill the thief. And, you know, like, again, like, I think like a dumber movie, you'd have some no-name character whispering to another, he's dressing up as a monk and he's going to use it to fool the thief. There's like no dialogue in this sequence. Like, the movie trusts you to understand what he's doing, or at least understand it when it comes about. But we finally get to the point where he fights the thief, and you don't even like see the combat. You see the thief like burst out, mortally wounded. But that is the first time that slow motion was used in the film for dramatic effect.
Wow.
You know, what I read about it, Neil, is that that's also the origin of the storytelling technique of, like, we're going to establish that this guy is the good guy by having him do something good that is unrelated to the primary plot of the movie.
Yeah. I think so. I just remember watching, like, the original King Kong.
Yeah.
Again, another black and white movie. And rather than, like, showing who the various characters are through these, like, little vignettes, it's all, like, given an exposition. Like, oh, that's Captain Jameson, and he, you know, he served as a destroyer captain in World War One, but now he's now he's our freighter captain. Like, instead here, like, before you even know the guy's name, you've established that he's, like, unconventional, he's clever, but he's also, you know, tough enough to at least take on a thief, and he doesn't seem to take payment for his work, so, like, you see that he's got, like, an altruistic streak.
Yeah, absolutely. Actually, that's something I want to get to for sure, and I want to throw to the other guys on. One of the things that I wrote when I was, like, writing down all my thoughts about this movie is that they do a really good job of introducing and setting up, like, all the different samurai. But I will say there was, like, I could describe, like, five of them for you. There's two of them that like, if you asked me to give them a particular character trait or describe, like, what their role was, I was, like, a little lost, and maybe I missed something.
I mean, one of them is, like, the guy who dies first. Like, that's his character.
He's, like, the original red shirt guy. So, what do you guys think about that? Did you have a similar reaction? I mean,
before we move on from first, Neil, you kind of covered this, but this has to be one of the first, like, getting the gang together sequences of all time, right?
Yeah. Like, again, like, the idea of, like, bringing the team together is not how most movies worked in the past.
Yeah, and probably made it over to the Western is, like, getting your posse together, and then now the modern bank heist or superhero bullshit film.
Yeah, Ocean's 11 is Seven Samurai, and Magnet, Bug's Life is Seven Samurai. And...
Yeah, Kurosawa has this, like, weird translation over into spaghetti Westerns. So the Magnificent Seven is, like, a direct ripoff of this. And then he made a movie called Yojimbo, which also stars Toshiro Mifune. And it had a sequel that I'm forgetting the name of, but those are directly ripped off by Sergio Leone for A Fistful of Dollars and A Few Dollars More.
So to get back to what Sam was saying, though, maybe Sam, Gideon, and me could have an exercise where we try to name all seven samurai, and Neil, you can fill in the ones that we missed.
Oh, shit.
So I can't name them.
Character archetypes. So we've got leader, young guy. We have the swords master, the guy who, and maybe my favorite or the coolest of all of them, who's like, no, really, you don't want to fight me. No, you really don't want to fight me. And then, okay. And then we have the guy who's splitting wood. I can't characterize his role.
And then the funny guy.
Funny guy, the guy who isn't really a samurai.
Right.
Is that funny guy, or are you talking about?
No, the other funny guy who would be, like, good in hard times.
Okay,
right?
So he's kind. Yes. Okay. The command. I don't know. He's got high charisma. There's one I can't put a name on.
Yeah.
Is it the bow guy?
Or is. Wasn't he the one who would be high spirit and good time?
That's the one I'm getting confused. I think his name is Garobi or something like that.
Go ahead, Sam.
That was the one that I had a hard time pinning down, because it's like, young guy, leader, Mifune, Heihachi, the woodcutter, the sword master, and then it's like those last two that I'm like, I don't remember those guys.
The woodcutter was the one who was going to raise the flag. He was the one who was good for hard times. I think that's all there was to him.
Yeah.
So we're totally missing a guy.
Yeah.
So the two that I agree, Sam, I think that these two guys are kind of forgettable and kind of fade into the background.
Mm-hmm.
So we have the leader, Shimada. We have Toshiro Mifune. You've got the young apprentice. You've got Heihachi, who's the woodcutter and jokester. And you have Kyuzo, the swordmaster. So those, I think those are the five that are like easily distinguishable. And then you've got, like you said, Gorobei, who's the archer, and kind of takes on like a second in command role.
Yeah. I like him. I don't think he's too forgettable.
Yeah, but
agreed.
I get him and Shichijiro, who's Shimada's is like old friend, and
yeah,
is also one of the three who survived till the end.
Mm-hmm.
But
right, I was surprised that guy survived. I was like, I mean, maybe that's the point, right? Is that like the ones that they killed were all the memorable. A lot of the memorable ones.
Like, I think it's confusing because, like, you've got the old friend who you would sort of think of as being, like, he should be second in command, but then you've got another guy who winds up being second in command. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to speak too badly of it, but those two are kind of mergeable.
And again, I think maybe this is a thing where if we were Japanese and living in the 50s and watching this movie, maybe there were some cultural things that would have made them a little bit more distinct. And it's possible that like there are some things that are lost in translation here. But it's hard to say this movie has many faults, but that was definitely one of the things that I got done with. And I was like, okay, if I was really nitpicking for problems here, I would say there's like one or two samurai that are kind of like lesser characters than, but you know, having a full cast of seven that are all really interesting, that would be a pretty tall order. Gideon, I haven't heard from you in a while.
Yeah, I definitely share what you said with kind of getting lost on some of the final samurai and kind of who's who, and that just could be my, you know, relative inexperience with the film and just how long it is and stuff. I was just thinking about how I think it, with the runtime being so massive and, you know, 3.5 hours long, you basically have to really commit to it. It's just so cool how it's able to tell this very like small little story about this small village that has this big problem, and you really get to like live in the world and like live with the characters and see the village through so many different ways. Like in these inside shots, you know, when it's raining and you can see their breath because it's so cold, like near the final battle, and seeing them like train up the villagers. It's just really cool how it just takes its time and lets it just live and breathe. And I felt like this movie felt so alive, even for how old it is. And it was just really cool seeing it just unfold and getting to spend so much time with the characters. It felt very earned, even though it's probably one of the longest movies I've ever seen.
I want to get your guys' take on this. So I don't know why I expected this, but there was a couple sword battle scenes where I was expecting, like the first one between the sword master and the guy who he's like, really, you don't want to fight me? I was expecting this movie to be the origin of the spray of blood. And not that I was not disappointed that that's not what it was, but I was very surprised how brutal and elegant the combat is in this movie. Where a lot of the times when they kill somebody with a sword, it's not like a clean strike. It's like they're just poking you to death 3 feet away, and they get like four or five guys on top of you at once, and then they just, and that's kind of it.
So I will say, no spray of blood, but there are a few like single cut deaths.
Mm.
In particular, I think the one we don't see the cut, but where he kills the criminal in the beginning, dressed up as a monk. And then remind me the name of the character, Neil, but the sword master, when he kills that guy who challenges him, there's only Yozo, there's only one strike there. There's just no spray of blood.
Right. Fact, I mean,
the whole movie is very blood light as I think about it, right?
Right.
And I think that's relatively realistic. I mean, it isn't like people spray blood when they die.
Right. I was just expecting it to be more like, you know, cut to Samurai 1, cut to Samurai 2, and it just goes down to their eyes, right? And then you get the kind of, I mean, like, and we didn't really get that.
We don't see any samurai on samurai combat either. One thing I wonder, this is just a question I don't know that we're qualified to answer, but was this movie perceived as very violent at the time? The way, you know, our parents were scared of ultra violence and rated R movies when we were kids.
Yeah, I mean, that's a super good question. I mean, along the lines of the violence, another thing that I think is, like, really interesting and I think is, like, very well directed and a great idea is, like, when they introduce the fact that there's three enemies with muskets, it's like, oh shit, these guys have fucking muskets. They're rolling up, and this is bad news. Which, you know, which is hilarious because they take like, you know, 2.5 minutes to reload these things, and these guys are still like, we better take out the musket guys first, or this is all over.
I did want to also mention one thing I really liked, and I like in almost anything that I see it, but all the really cool, just visual storytelling and no dialogue stuff, like, you know, it could be so easy to get lost in something that's this long of a movie. But the way he's able to, you know, he's crossing out how many bandits they've killed, and even like the banner, how it represents them in the village, it's like very well done. And it's kind of crazy how focused it all seems, even especially at the end battle. It's like, you know, you're basically hearing about this battle that's going to happen the whole movie, and then you get like a 40 minute like epic fight for the whole village, and you know, it didn't feel like, oh, that was kind of rushed or whatever. It's like, no, like they were fighting for a while and dealing with it.
I think the rain does so much to dial up the intensity of that last battle and make it satisfying. And then They saved a few people to kill too at the end, which also was the characters to kill off, which also added to the weight of that scene. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I didn't think Mifune was going to die at all, and then he did, and I was supremely disappointed.
Yeah, I was sad when he died.
What do you guys? What are the standout? If you had to pick a standout scene in this movie, what would you guys? Would you guys say?
Well, I already said.
Go ahead, Alex. Maybe Neil, you should go last.
Okay.
For your, I think it's not a single scene, but I was just impressed with how much time they spent gathering the samurai. I think maybe my standout scene is some of the stuff with the farmers who we've barely talked about, but where they really spend a lot of time driving home how poor these like farmers are. They get made fun of in their little like hostel, and they can't do anything. You know, they're like begging for mercy. I thought that was kind of compelling.
I would say the thing that stands out to me the most are all the scenes where Toshiro Mifune is interacting with the village children. That stuff is so funny, and he's so great and so believable and such a over the top charismatic presence in this movie. Like all that stuff with him is just so strong. Even his dramatic kind of monologue in the middle where he admits to being raised by farmers and all that. But yeah, like all the scenes, the comedic scenes with him, I think were my favorite stuff.
I think for me, I really liked how like relatable the plight of the farmers was. Like when you see that shot and they're trying to pick up the rice that like was spilled, it's like everybody gets hungry, so you can totally relate to just like they're starving and they like literally don't even have money. Like they can only bargain with the crops they grow, and just seeing that shot of like, it's like, here you go, you can count how many rice little pieces they can pick up, you know, and that's all they have on that, you know, couple frames that you see it. And I really liked also just the when they go to the like bandit camp by like the waterfall or wherever they are, and you find out like the farmer's wife was taken by them, right?
And then she thing to a twist in this movie because they hint at it very heavily. Mm-hmm. And I think by the time we got there, I'm guessing most of us had figured out what was going on. But
well, doesn't she also run back in to like kill herself basically?
Because she's so ashamed or something. I don't know.
Yeah. I wasn't sure why, but yeah, I mean, I thought that was cool. And yeah, same thing with the rain really adding to the emotionality and intensity of everything. And it was just crazy. I mean, just seeing those horses like run through at that speed in that much like mud and everything, I was like, this movie looks like people could have died trying to do this shit. Like, yeah, so it was crazy to see.
You know, it is a very old movie thing that I don't know what year this went out of vogue, but I feel like, and this could be Japanese movies, this could be American movies, pre-1950, the hysterical screaming woman in movies was like a very common thing where somebody is just like, for like 5 minutes at a time, and they're like being dragged away and then like thrown into a burning barn or whatever. I just feel like at a certain point that became like totally not in vogue. And there isn't a movie past like 1960 that has that in it. And I feel like every movie that I've seen before 1960 has like the hysterical screaming woman in it.
Neil, what was your favorite scene?
Well, I kind of mentioned it with one of my favorites with the opening with the thief, but two more that stick out to me are, so one, like, despite the serious content of this movie, I like that there are moments of levity. A lot of it is carried by Toshiro Mifune's character, but one that sticks out is when the young samurai like sort of jerks his duties and goes off into the mountains, and he comes across the peasant girl who's dressed as a boy. He like admonishes her, like, "What are you doing? Now is not the time to be picking flowers," and he's waving like a flower stem at her because he was just doing that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think another really great one is the sequence where Shimada tells the young man to like stand by the door frame with a stick over his head and attack the next samurai who comes in. And you get the first guy who's like, seems to be a very good fighter. And, you know, he, you know, just trounces the kid, like catches his blow, flips him around and has to be mollified. But then he's like, "No, I'm not going to just fight for rice." And that's sort of contrasted with, I believe it's Gorobe, who like doesn't even enter. Like, he's already wise to the,
yeah, he just laughs.
Like, yeah, you must be joking. And then, you know, comedy comes in threes, and then you get Toshiro Mifune's character, and he just takes the stick across the head.
Yeah. I feel like this is also from an era where, like, actors had zero rights, and so directors could just do whatever the hell they wanted to them, and there was, like, nothing they could do about it. And they were, generally speaking, good sports about it, too, where you could just abuse the hell out of your actors and throw them off horses and shit, and they were getting paid nothing. And they were just like happy to be there. You know, I admire that.
Go ahead,
Gideon.
I also liked how, like, I think the master and maybe one other samurai, but they like stood up for the girl that was being abused by her asshole dad who cut her hair. And her guy friend or whatever, samurai, he didn't even show up, right? Like, when all that was going down in the village, so
Neil explained that to me because I found it very surprising too. But you said there was something cultural about how he stood aside while that was happening.
I mean, like, I think this is something that's a little more, you know, just sort of a thing that's happened in a lot of cultures, Western and Eastern. But basically, you know, his daughter is his property, so. You know, he would hope to, you know, marry her to another like influential villager or something, and instead she'd be like, I think he calls her damaged goods because she's no longer a virgin.
Yeah.
But then why would her lover not defend her?
Yeah.
Or, you know.
Because in a strictly legal sense, he's in the wrong. Like, he shouldn't have done that.
Like, it's as if he's stolen something or something to that effect.
Yeah.
We're not, of course, that's of the time. We're not
Right, but yeah. Even with that, it was still interesting. Didn't like another villager like yell at the dad and be like, what about like marrying for love or something like that?
I think it was more just like,
we're all about to die.
Yeah, yeah, like we got bigger fish to fry kind of thing.
Yeah, like I think the farmer's name is Monzo. Like, mm-hmm. you know, he's like so concerned with like, you know, keeping his daughter quote unquote safe that he's like neglecting the village at times.
Right, like what's the old man say? Like your head is on the chopping block and all you care about is your whiskers.
Yeah.
Like, by the way, here's my favorite scene in the movie is like the next day when they're all at the gate together and he says we're expecting a lot from this young man now since he since he's not a virgin anymore.
Oh yeah, that was so funny.
It's fucking great.
Isn't it funny how like humor among men crosses it crosses not only like cultural boundaries but also a period of like 90 years
or 400 years.
Exactly. It's just that's one of those things that it's just like so it's so beautiful to see comedy come together like that across, you know, just huge
having a
periods of time
like that too.
The delivery is much better than I did. It really holds up.
It does absolutely hold up. Yeah.
Yeah. There's a like going out and getting into a fight with your bros energy to this movie. Like there's just such a, like a strong broship between the seven samurai and like the people in the village and things like that.
Yeah.
That's kind of like timeless and admirable.
So, I mean, I guess that brings up something I wanted to touch on is like the mercenary element of this movie. Where, you know, we spend 3 hours with all these characters. And like, you know, we see them celebrating together. We see them like getting to know one another as like the villagers reveal that they have captured equipment from like defeated samurai that they hunted down and killed. We find out later that, you know, they are hoarding like sake and like delicacy food, you know, stored away for special events. And, you know, they're not as poor as they presented themselves to be. But, you know, at the very end, you know, like, you know, they bring the samurai into their village and the samurai like start to integrate a little bit. But once the bandits are defeated, you know, Rikichi takes his house back from the samurai. They get back to farming and the samurai are sort of back to square one. Like, they're not really part of the community and never really were, despite most of them dying for the community.
Damn.
Neil, is there anything you don't like about this movie? It ends.
No, I think there's frustration sometimes, particularly with the young character, where like, you know, Alex brought up like, dude, stand up for your lover, and the fact that the two separate at the end, like, dude, come on, like you just helped kill 40 bandits, like take your girl with you.
We want resolved, but I think it's mature of the film to not give us everything we
want. No, like I think it's also like a believable choice within the story.
It hurts and life hurts, you know, and that's a lesson he's learning. I had an unresolved question for Neil before we close out, but if you have other thoughts on what you don't like, Neil, or what you might not like.
No, I really can't think of anything I would change.
Okay, here's my question for you. The whole film is premised on the farmers being extremely poor. And they allude to this throughout the film. I don't know any of the names, I'm sorry. Crazy Samurai, bad fake samurai, says something about this as we explore his roots as a farmer. He's like, oh no, they actually have a lot stashed away. And we find out on the eve of the final battle that it's true. They have extra rice, they have beans, they have sake. They share it with the samurai finally. And they have all this armor lying around. So is it really true that they have no money or resources? And was that trying to tell us something about the dishonesty of the farmer? Or yeah, is it like, what is that supposed to be?
I think that that is like, I think that's sort of the twist that you guys were waiting for, is that it's not as one dimensional as the initial story presents itself. I mean, like, you just sort of consider that, like, you know, Kyozo goes out and he kills one of the musket bandits, and Kikicho does something similar. But, like, at the end of the day, like, it wasn't, like, a straight-up battle between the seven samurai and 40 bandits. You know, they formed the farmers up into spearmen squads, and the farmers get a good number of the kills. You know, like, at the end of the day, could the farmers have fought off these bandits by themselves? Like, I think so. Casualties probably would have been a lot higher, but I think they could have made a good show of it, you know. And so yeah, I think that it's just like an element of, you know, there is more going on than the initial story presents itself as.
What you were getting at with the mercenary nature of the film, that in some ways the farmers are really using the samurai, and they use them up, like,
yeah,
you know, at their expense. Yeah,
I mean, maybe that is supposed to say something about like the role of the samurai in the history of Japan or something like that, or how Akira Kurosawa feels about the nature. But of course, like, not only am I not an expert, I don't have the colloquial knowledge of, you know, being Japanese to really understand that stuff in a deep way. But, you know, I definitely would be interested to read more about that and interpretations of this movie. One thing, once I finish any of the movies we do for the podcast, I thought about it for a little bit. Sometimes I head out to Wikipedia and I'm like, okay, so why is this an important movie or whatever? Like, what are the themes? Like, what do critics believe the themes of this movie to be? And I was surprised to, like, not really find a lot of that stuff regarding Seven Samurai. Most of the academic discussion on this movie is about, like, filmmaking techniques and, like, the technical aspect and multi-camera and the storytelling techniques that we kind of established earlier. So I'm sure there are those deeper themes, but I'd have to dig a little bit deeper if I was going to find any of that stuff out. So let's go around and give a score real quick. We're coming up on the hour. Let's give a score real quick. This is the first movie of our season two, and I think we're going to go ahead and move to a 5-star system to appease the website letterboxd.com, so we can track our rankings that way easier. So I would personally go ahead and give this a 4. Not that there's like anything super wrong with this movie that really takes that star off. I just think that it is one of those movies that you hear so much about just colloquially through others and through academic sources. You should watch it if you're like going to be a cinephile, as it were. But I think it's less notable for its entertainment value and more notable for the technical innovations that it brought to filmmaking and the storytelling innovations, not because it is super entertaining to watch in the year 2024, if that makes any sense. At least that's where I would come at it from. Like, so I think 4 is appropriate for that. It's like hard to stick your finger in anywhere and find something that doesn't really work. But I think if like a modern filmmaker made this, they could like shave some time off and make it a little bit tighter, fix up some things. So yeah, I'd go like 4 out of 5 for me personally.
Do we do half stars in this system, or are they gone?
You can, yeah, on Letterboxd. Yeah,
you can do half star and still on Letterboxd.
Okay, I'll go. I have so much trouble giving this anything other than a 5 for its length. I was never bored. And I give just a little bit of grace on strangeness for films before, you know, film before 1970 or whatever. And I will say, for a film of that era, it is unique and entertaining enough. I don't know. I would recommend it to a lot of people. Anyone who has 3 hours to kill.
3.5 hours.
And a half.
Intermission.
Now, Neil, before we get to your score and Gideon's score, I need to ask you, as an ultra fan of this movie, do you watch the intermission? I mean, is that the intended experience?
I mean, I think the intended experience for the intermission is, you know, go and get another box of popcorn, get your soda refilled. Right. But you have to do it. You have to do it in that time frame.
So okay.
You can't wait 20 minutes for your pizza to arrive. It's
right.
You've got the intermission to get your snacks.
Right. I debated doing that. I debated just to get the full experience sitting there and watching the entire 10-minute intermission that was on the Blu-ray. So Neil, I can assume you're probably a 5.
Yeah. I definitely get where you're coming from. Where, you know, like, or I think it's kind of like it's so far back in time, but also like we brought up the Grand Illusion earlier, where it's like so archaic that I don't think it's like comparable to a modern movie. Except as far as the contrasts go, like, but you're dealing with a different animal, like, as like the, if we're going to call Seven Samurai like the precursor or like the first modern film, I think you have to compare them. But in some ways it is comparing like a Model T to like a modern Ferrari, like,
right?
Yes, they're both cars, yes, they both do the same thing, but like, you know, there's been time to polish, there's been time to, you know, improve the max speed, that kind of stuff. So yeah, I think I still have to give it a 5, but I definitely get why you might want to take some points off.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and last but not least, Gideon.
Yeah, I mean, I also totally understand where you're coming from. I almost felt like kind of disappointed the first time I watched it, and I was like, almost like, that's it. Like, I almost, it has such an epic reputation, I almost expected like these bombastic like battle scenes, and we do get this epic like fight at the end and everything. But I guess it wasn't the same way that I had thought. But upon revisiting it, and just kind of watching it for what it is and just soaking it in, like, yeah, it's definitely a 5. It's just really cool to watch and experience. It is a bit of a harder recommend for me, because I feel like this is a movie, it's like you have to want it. You know, you have to want to sit and watch a 3.5-hour movie that's in black and white with Japanese audio that you have to read the whole time. And for most people, they're not going to want that.
Yeah.
You know? So I would definitely say, like, yeah, you should, if you're wanting to get more into movies, you might as well check this out at some point. You know?
Yeah. Yeah, absolutely. I think that's a good summation, right? Is that it's like a cinematic must if you want to like get it heavier into movies, just to see like where everything started, where everything came from. But, you know, it has some anachronisms that are kind of like, you know, it makes it a little bit harder of a recommendation for a modern audience. But still, there's so much here that's totally masterful. And again, I would just reiterate that Mifune's performance, I think, is like one of the strongest pre-Brando era performances that I think I've ever seen in my life. Just incredibly great. So yeah, what do we decide we're going to do for next week, guys? Whose turn was it?
Is it Alex's?
I had recommended Hard Boiled. I'm so tempted right now to switch my recommendation to Ben-Hur, which I think,
oh my god, another like 4-hour.
Yeah, just to compare and contrast, but let's just stick with Hard Boiled.
Oh, yeah, or like the Ten Commandments or something.
I've heard so many good things about this movie. I've been craving like a good like kung fu, a serious alternative. Maybe we can compare and contrast to Kung Pao.
Oh yeah, you're gonna love. I've seen Hard Boiled. I love Hard Boiled. You're gonna like this movie.
I'm excited. Never seen it.
So I don't have a history with it. But
I
we can give ourselves a fun week after a couple of serious like. Yeah.
So here's a fun story about me and Hard Boiled. This is actually, it revolves around the house on Searley that we all lived in college, Gideon. There was like a bunch of people in the downstairs that were like not the normal crew. I mean, not just like all the guys who were living there, but there was like, you know, like Paige Plaska was there and Oliveria was there. There was just like 5 or 6 different people sitting there on the couch, and I was like intensely watching Hard Boiled, and we were like 90 minutes into the movie, and I looked around and everybody was on their phone, and I stopped the movie and I yelled at everybody.
Dude, that's fucking awesome. That's hilarious.
That was the precursor to the like, babe, are you on your phone right now? Did you not see the Criterion logo before the movie started? Like, what's wrong with you?
That's our guy.
Yeah.
Fighting the good fight.
Yeah, it's like, no, we gotta sit here and watch the intermission and drink sake, Grace. Yeah. You don't understand.
I told you, we don't watch movies, we watch films.
Okay, you know, well,
can we orchestrate a birthday viewing or something this weekend of Hard Boiled? We'll talk about it offline.
Well, yeah, I mean, on that note, guys, before he goes, you should wish Alex a happy birthday on the podcast.
Oh, what day is your birthday?
Sunday.
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 Are you looking forward to? Do you have any? Are you doing anything special?
We're gonna. Neil's gonna sing Justin Bieber songs at karaoke.
Nice.
Oh, nice.
I didn't promise that.
Well, we're gonna get you drunk enough that you feel like you're 21 again.
You guys should do.
I'm feeling 22.
You guys should do the Hard Boiled challenge where you each you watch Hard Boiled while eating a dozen hard boiled eggs.
Oh god, jeez.
I'm allergic.
Oh
to eggs.
Yeah, me too.
That probably would kill me.
Yeah. Same here. Okay.
Happy early birthday, Alex.
Yeah.
Thanks, guys.
All right. Well, I'll see you guys here next week, and see you later.
Sayonara.
Later.
Later.